It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll look at Governor Walker's recent comments suggesting he might run for a third term and what that can mean for Republicans and Democrats alike here in the state. First, Judith Sears-Poisson joins us in the studio because it's our year-end membership drive. You count on WPR for in-depth talk about the issues. We count on you to keep these discussions going strong. Make your contribution now. It makes a big difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
That's right, Rob. And last hour, we heard from 17 listeners. Thank you so much for those pledges. Our goal this hour is to get 15 pledges. Help us meet this goal by making a contribution now. You can do that at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You know, the programs you enjoy will be here every day on Wisconsin Public Radio, thanks to your support.
On the Ideas Network, you hear from people who add to the story, who give you information you need. Maybe the person who wrote the legislation we're talking about, who wrote the book we're talking about, someone with expertise or an interesting perspective. We seek these people out and get them on the show. It's a great privilege to be able to do that for you, but it's your support that makes it possible. Make great radio happen now with your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, this time of year is a time, I think, when we all think about charity and giving a little bit back. Well, during this year-end membership drive, we have a really special thank you gift. Besides supporting the programs you count on WPR, you can ask for food for 20 when you give $60 or food for 40 when you give $120.
Another way to do that, so you can break those amounts up into a monthly sustaining gift of $5 a month or $10 a month, your thank you gift will provide meals to a Wisconsin food bank near you. Get started now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Do you know that WPR has been around for almost 100 years? It's 100 years. Well, that's amazing because to be around that long, it means that you have to be committed to quality. And that quality is possible thanks to you. Listener donations make up the single largest piece of our budget.
Your contribution makes this program possible. So many others as well. Helps us kick off the next century of Wisconsin Public Radio. You are part of the quality you hear every day on WPR when you donate at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're pretty sure that the programs you hear on WPR make a difference in your life. You're listening right now. It's a good bet that you listen a little bit every day, maybe a lot every day. During this year-end membership drive, we're asking you to put your money where your values are.
Each year, listeners who value Wisconsin Public Radio give what they can to support us here at WPR. If you're already a member, thanks so much for making these conversations possible. If you're not yet, it's a great day to become one with your contribution at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
15 more pledges to go and about 50 minutes to get them. Your goal right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 really helps.
Remember this pledge drive, you have a chance to do two good things at once. Ask for food for 20 when you give $5 a month or food for 40 when you give $10 a month. You do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
If you're not already a sustaining member of WPR, think about becoming one right now. It's easy to set up convenient, ongoing monthly donations from either your bank account or your credit card. You set it up. You don't have to worry about it. It'll always be a current membership, and you can do all that now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We have a lot of interesting conversations coming up today alone here on Central Time. Issues in the national, international news, things closer to home right here in Wisconsin. We do a lot on the show, very serious, important topics, maybe things off the beaten path, and we try to have fun, too, and try to bring on some fascinating perspectives. You are a Central Time listener because you enjoy that. You enjoy that diversity of conversation. Now become a Central Time supporter, a Wisconsin Public Radio member, by making a contribution. Do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Again, that's WPR.org, 888-202-2552. You know, every day on Central Time, you will hear topics that people are talking about, things that are happening in the news, and also things that just make life better and more interesting. exciting. We try for a great mix of programs. We do 30 different segments a week, all with you in mind. So please show your support right now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Judith will check in a bit, hopefully with some good news about our pledges today. First, though, while much of the nation speculates on who will be elected next year as the president of the United States, here in Wisconsin, there's been some attention, some speculation about who's going to be elected governor in 2018.
Speaking at an economic summit yesterday, Governor Walker had this to say about his political future.
And so we're committed not just over the next couple years, for the next 3 years as I'm governor, if God willing, if in the future as voters, you ask me to continue to stand for 4 more years after that.
Those comments have sparked a lot of discussion around Wisconsin today. While we're 3 years away from that race for governor, gives us a lot to talk about between now and then. So if Walker decides, hey, he's going to give it another go, what would he be up against in 2018? And is this what voters in Wisconsin would really want?
Here with us now to talk about these questions and more is Charlie Jacobs. He's an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College. Charlie, welcome back.
Thank you.
So right there, Governor Walker hinting at a possible third term, maybe pretty broad hint. It may come as a surprise, though, to people. It seemed the thinking was, as pundits sort of analyzed where he was with this failed presidential nomination, and that maybe Governor Walker's time as governor was drawing to a close. What do you make of those comments yesterday?
It's a bit surprising, only because I think really our last really sort of check in with the governor in a meaningful way, and his political aspirations was the sort of deflating end of his run for the GOP nod, and so he kind of came limping back to the state of Wisconsin, licking his wounds a bit, and I think some suspected that kind of might be a swan song, especially when you looked at some of the polls that were coming out of Marquette University, where his unfavorables were really high, and his approval ratings were pretty low. So I think that we all suspected that he might be reconsidering where his political future was going. But, you know, time heals all wounds, and he gets a little perspective, and maybe the public here in Wisconsin does too. And maybe his tea leaf reading suggests to him that he's got a little bit more political life here as governor, and that might set him up for something else on the national stage in years to come.
Now, imagine if you're governor, you don't say things like that off the cuff without giving it some forethought. What do you think he was hoping to achieve by dropping that little bit yesterday?
I think for him, he's signaling constituencies that he needs to signal if he's even contemplating this kind of run. I mean, American politics now has been the race for money, and you can't sit on the sideline and hope that if you jump in very late to a race or announce a bid for a third term, that everyone is just going to scramble to your door and fill up your war chest really easily. You have to be kind of on this at all times. I mean, ask any member of the United States Senate who's literally raising thousands of dollars a day just to stay in the race. So I think part of this is to suggest to donors and to the public who might push him and support him to that run in 2018 that I am in the game and I might be coming and knocking on your door soliciting some donations from you to make me a viable and credible candidate in 3 years. Because if he sits in the sidelines, I mean, there might be somebody who creeps up behind him and he doesn't even notice it. And before long, he's got a primary and he's got to worry about a challenger with his own party as well as somebody who might creep up from the Democratic Party.
But isn't he also tipping his hand to Democrats who have more time to ready whoever might run against him?
I'm not sure if the Democrats have even really considered this in a meaningful way. I think what we've seen from the Democratic Party in Wisconsin over the last couple of years is sort of a realization that they don't have a particularly deep bench. And I think that the recruitment process is going to be rather difficult for them, especially if Walker's in the race. Because even though his numbers might be a little low, he's a daunting candidate. I mean, he's a good campaigner. He's a good politician. He runs credible races. And as you can see from the last couple of races that he's run, he's handled pretty well the Democrats and some of the best that the Democrats had to offer. So a strategic candidate on the Democratic side might actually be scared off by this kind of announcement because it might seem as though he is readying himself already for a race. And so I'm not sure whether or not somebody who is sort of preparing or thinking about the governor's race on the Democratic side is going to really decide to sort of jump in with both feet if the governor's going to run again. That doesn't seem like the strategic move by a Democrat.
I mean, on the other hand, you earlier used the phrase swan song, and Walker has seen fading poll numbers ever since that failed campaign for the presidency. Is that going to be hanging over his head in the political future? And granted, this is, you know, pretty far down the road, 2018. Do you think voters are going to move on from that, or is it something that's going to linger?
I think it depends on the kind of policies he and the legislature decide to take on, and looking sort of deeper into poll numbers, not just at Walker's poll numbers, but at some of the other concerns and some of the other policy initiatives that seem to be pressed by Republicans in the state. I think that if they can ameliorate some of the issues that really seem to be pressing among the public, that he might be able to win over some of those voters who have disappeared on him. And quite honestly, if you look at the poll numbers, he's still running very strong with Republicans. They support him overwhelmingly, and as would be expected, Democrats don't. I think what's probably alarming is how he's lost some independents. But, you know, independents are independent, and they can be persuaded more easily than partisans can. So if he starts to turn around some of these issues, job creation, issues related to transportation and transportation funding, issues related to education, I think maybe he can win back some of those voters. He's got a hole to dig out of, but I think it's something that he could possibly turn around if he's engaged in the process as he is this early.
We're talking about Governor Walker's recent comments suggesting he might run for a third term as a state's governor in the year 2018, talking with political scientist Charlie Jacobs, and we'll have more with him in just a bit.
You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. If Governor Walker were to run again, would you support him? If you're a Republican, would you want 4 more years of Scott Walker, or do you want to see someone else from the GOP step up and make a run at the state's top office? If you're a Democrat, is there a candidate you'd like to see challenge whoever ends up on the Republican side of things in a few years? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking right now with political scientist Charlie Jacobs about Governor Walker's recent comments suggesting he might run for a third term as the state's governor in 2018. We're looking at what that could mean for the state going forward.
And you can join in with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. Do you see a path forward for Walker's third term? Would you support him in another governor's race? And do you think his failed presidential campaign helps or hurts his political future here in Wisconsin? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Charlie, you mentioned right before we last spoke that some issues on the agenda for Governor Walker are transportation and education, and you used the phrase he's got a hole to dig out of. Let's look at that a little more closely. How would you describe, I guess, that hole you're talking about?
I think for Walker, he's got to be cognizant of the fact that I think he entered the presidential race with the idea of sort of burnishing his reputation as a kind of a Reagan-era Republican who was protective of your property rights by lower taxation and being good steward of the public treasury. And in doing so, he wrote a budget that I think it has sort of painted the state into a corner a bit. And I think if you look at some of the data regarding, you know, the public opinion about the transportation spending and the willingness of the public to borrow to spend rather than to maybe tax our way out of that problem, might put him in a quandary. So he doesn't want to sort of represent himself as a tax and spend governor, but at the same time, some estimates are that over the next 10 years, just in maintenance costs on state roads, we're talking about $6 billion or so. And we just borrowed $350 million for some of the really pressing projects. So that's the kind of local issue. Everybody drives or everybody's on the roads, and the more potholes that pop up and the more, you know, failed bridges that require detours really resonate with the public. And so it's these kind of local issues that he's got to be really concerned about. These are the ones that I think we see in polls where people have opinions, as opposed to things like the civil service reforms that he and the legislature are proposing and the GAB reforms, where, you know, half or more of the public have no opinion because they don't really know the context text or the content of the bill, but it's these really homegrown issues like, can you vote on a referendum repeatedly for your local school district to increase funding? How are the roads when you drive to work or take your kids to school? These are the issues that he's got to worry about, and they cost a lot of money. So between now and the next election, if he really is considering running, I think those are the kinds of things he has to address with the leadership in the legislature to make sure they address them in a way that the public approves.
And do you think 3 years is enough to shore those areas up?
It may be quite difficult simply because of the way in which they've addressed some of the issues to close the budget gap that was apparent when he first came to office in 2011. So I think that they've been very creative and they've cut where they've seen fat. But after a time, the fat gets pretty lean, and you're going to have to try to find some other ways to provide the services that the public expects. That often leads to taxation. And I think that some citizens, when they look west and they see the success in Minnesota, where they are running a large budget deficit, where you're seeing Republicans and Democrats just arguing about what to do with all of the money, I think there's going to start to be a little bit of tax envy or surplus envy on the other side of our state. And that might be a consideration for the public. Why can they do it over there and we can't do it over here?
Now, looking at possible challenges to that 2018 run, should Governor Walker run? Now, in the last two gubernatorial elections and the recall election, Democrats have had a hard time finding a formidable candidate to run against Governor Walker. So does that speak to more of a weakness on the part of Democrats, or is that just speaking to the strength of Walker as a candidate?
I think it's a little bit of both. I don't think you can explain it simply because the Democrats don't have anyone. I mean, they do. They have some credible candidates. But one of the things they have to understand about most candidates is that when we look at their behavior, we understand candidates as being very, very strategic. They try to plan out their political careers because, you know, you can really make an error of judgment if you jump into a race that you're almost guaranteed to lose. And if you don't have anything to fall back on, it might be the end of your political career. So a lot of candidates can be very cautious about what races they want to run and when they want to run them. So you might have somebody who would be a really good candidate against somebody like Scott Walker, but they might be fearful about what he can bring to bear in the campaign. And so they pull their punches and they don't want to throw their hat in the ring because they're just afraid they're going to lose and then they're going to become sort of this permanent backbencher in their own party and never have the opportunity to run for high office again. So I think that's one of the things that's facing. They have seen Scott Walker win three elections and win them pretty handily against candidates that I think had a credible chance against him. So I think there's going to be some fear on the Democratic side that if he does it again, if he raises that money, utilizes it well, sort of galvanizes his support again, that they're going to lose, and they don't want to do that.
So as we said, Governor Walker has tipped his hand, at least as of yesterday, this week, that he is considering looking favorably toward that 2018 run. But if he decided not to do that, what avenues might lie open to him? What are some options that he might pursue instead?
Yeah, he's always been a little coy about whether or not if a member of the Republican Party won the presidency in 2016, whether he'd be open to a position in the cabinet. And I'm not sure whether or not he's completely foreclosed that opportunity. I mean, there are some places that you can gain a really good reputation nationally and build some name recognition and prepare yourself for a future run at the White House. Now, some might say, well, that's something that Tommy Thompson tried, and it didn't work out too well for him, and maybe that's not the greatest launching pad. Maybe the seat in a governor's mansion is a much better place to do it. But I think his little stumbles that he had in this go-around might suggest to him he needs a different platform. And so maybe for him, if he doesn't run, he's hopeful that someone will come calling for him from Washington, D.C., or maybe he'll try his hand at some other national office if it becomes available.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. He joined us to talk about Governor Walker's recent comments, suggesting he might run for a third term as the state's governor in 2018. Last weekend, state Justice Department officials raided a Department of Corrections facility for juveniles in Irma, Wisconsin. The raid was part of an ongoing John Doe investigation into conditions at the facility and allegations of abuse, negligence, and mismanagement.
The Lincoln Hills School for Young Offenders in northern Wisconsin is located south of Tomahawk. About 300 people, mostly males, are being held at that facility. Patrick Marley's been covering the story for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us, what are some of the alleged crimes that are being investigated in this investigation of the Lincoln Hills facility?
There's a whole host of things they're looking at, and the judge said that there's reason to believe that crimes that have occurred include second-degree sexual assault, strangulation, excessive use of pepper spray, destruction of records, laws perhaps were violated governing how state facilities are supposed to be run, child neglect, child abuse. The list is very long.
And apart from the potential criminal acts themselves, it sounds like there are concerns about mismanagement, failure to report crimes, as you mentioned, and serious safety concerns more widely for both staff and inmates there. What do we know about the conditions at this facility?
Well, I've spent the last day talking to current and former staff up in that area, and they say that the situation there has become much more volatile in recent years, much more disruptive. The kids are acting out, and they're having there are a lot of fights with youth fighting other youth, or situations where they're hitting staff or attempting to strike staff. Staff are having put their hands on them when these incidents occur, and people are getting hurt.
You mentioned a few years ago, and in your reporting, you noted that a few years ago, 2011, I think, the Ethan Allen School was closed. Inmates there, many of them moved to Lincoln Hills. Are people saying, hey, there's a connection here?
Yeah, I think that there's pretty broad agreement that problems started around the time those two schools were merged. They closed the Ethan Allen prison, which school facility, which is in suburban Milwaukee, because the number of the juveniles were decreasing, and so they put them all in one place, that's Lincoln Hills. Around that time that they merged those schools together is about the time that problems started to develop. Everybody says this is something that's been gradual over a number of years and has just gotten out of hand.
We've heard from your reporting and others that staff have been trying to raise these concerns, current and former staff, not in the last week, but over months, maybe even longer. So this isn't necessarily a surprise, at least to people who've been listening to them.
Yeah, I mean, staff have been raising concerns. The union has been putting out news releases. They've been contacting the Department of Corrections, saying they think there's a situation here. This investigation, it's really sort of become wide public knowledge in the last week, but this investigation began in January from the State Department of Justice, so almost a year now. Back in the fall, they had the special investigators for the Department of Corrections involved. So this has been a very wide-ranging probe, parallel investigations going on for a long time, and there have been people raising concerns since before then.
Talking to Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel about the ongoing investigation of the Lincoln Hills School. This is a juvenile facility in northern Wisconsin run by the Department of Correction. Department of Public Instruction has a role to play, too, with education there. This raid this weekend, Patrick, fairly dramatic. You don't often see one branch of state government raiding a facility run by another one. What happened this weekend?
Around 6 a.m. on Saturday, 50 agents and attorneys for the Department of Justice showed up, did a virtual occupation of the place, held some staff over who were coming off of their shift, brought in people as they were coming in to do interviews. There were two agents, or an agent and an attorney, interviewing each staff member individually. This week they've been interviewing the youth who live there. It looks like they're talking to virtually everybody who has anything to do with that place, logging any concerns, and then delving into detail. In fact, their resources, they're running out of space. They're actually doing interviews and things in buildings outside of the Lincoln Hill School in the town of Merrill. This seems like an extremely thorough investigation.
Give us a little background. Who is held at this facility?
So this facility has young kids, Generally, they leave when they're 18, but there are some people there who stay until the age of 21. So it's a mix of, you know, you've got some kids who are 14 or 15, and then you've got 19-year-olds, so a pretty big mix. There, it's mostly boys. There are two, they call them cottages. They've got these small housing units that are scattered on across their campus. They have, I believe, two units with girls in them. So they've got these places where they've got two staff, essentially, in a building with up to 50 kids, and then patrol officers who will stop by there if there are problems that arise. And so, you know, alarms are sounded if things get disruptive in a particular cottage.
There have been concerns since this came out this week over the leadership at this facility, maybe beyond higher up in the state government. Is that one of the next questions, trying to figure out who knew what and how they responded?
Yes. I mean, you had people last week. There was this secret John Doe hearing that we didn't know about at the time, but on Thursday they convened this John Doe hearing and brought in two current or former staff, interviewed them. That same day, the superintendent for the school was taken out of his job, and then the person in Madison who is in charge of the division that oversees that school, the Division of Juvenile Corrections, he was taken out of his job. That guy, Paul Westerhaus, formerly ran the school for a very long time up in Irma.
And you were looking into the role that the head of the Department of Corrections played in raising these concerns and addressing these concerns. What do we know at that level?
Well, Ed Wall has said that they're taking this very seriously. He's the corrections secretary, that they're taking this seriously, that protecting youth is their number one concern, and that they think he's saying simultaneously that he thinks that there's a small number of people who are responsible for these problems, but that also there's a culture at the school, he has been told, that is problematic. But, you know, he says a small group of people. You also have to keep in mind he did relieve the top two people of their duties overseeing the school. They had previously announced that they were going to retire in January. This is John Arata, the former superintendent of the school, and Paul Westerhaus. But they were going to retire on the same day in January. Ed Wall praised them. This is just a few weeks ago. And then last Thursday, had them both taken out of their jobs immediately.
That Ethan Allen School we mentioned earlier closed in part as a cost-saving measure. We see among the complaints from the staff there forced overtime. Are we in a position where the state saved some money by closing one facility, but at least according to workers there, didn't give them the resources to cope with the school now with inmates from both of those facilities at one place?
Overtime is and staff shortages are a problem that are widespread throughout the Department of Corrections. There are a number of state prisons. You can go talk to workers from any of them. They say they are forced to work many 16-hour shifts, that overtime is something that's happening all the time. Lincoln Hills is no different than that. They have people who, you know, they don't have enough people to do all the work. So this is a secure facility. You've got to have the right number of posts filled 24 hours a day. And so people are made to work a lot of hours. And you talk to those people and they say it's a stressful environment. You've got, you know, it's unpredictable. It's chaotic. You got some kids who are raising some potential, you know, raising some serious disruptions at times. And that's hard to take for 8 hours. And it's really hard to take for 16 hours.
Well, given that chaos, risks of safety, this investigation has been going on since January. Some incidents, I think, reported since then. Have there been concrete steps to try to boost safety for the inmates and the staff there? And are there new steps being taken now after this raid?
The Department of Corrections is not telling us a lot about all of the things that they are doing because the investigation is ongoing, but they also say that, you know, as they learn information, they're changing policies. I've talked to people who have said in recent weeks new policies have been implemented or policies that are on the books that hadn't been followed are now being more stringently applied. So there does seem to be an attempt to try to change the way things are done there. But we don't have a lot of specifics on what those are.
One group we haven't talked about related to this investigation are among the people being interviewed. Are they talking to current and former inmates at the facility?
I don't know about former inmates. They are talking to current inmates. I know that yesterday and perhaps Tuesday they were interviewing them one-on-one, and that now new allegations are surfacing. I mean, I think anytime they talk to somebody, they often learn new things, and then they have to go check out to see if that's, you know, those concerns that they're raising are valid. And so I think that every day they're coming up with new things that they need to go look into.
Have we heard anything yet on this from the governor or the state legislature?
Only in the very early day. The governor was briefed by Attorney General Brad Schimmel last week. He has said that he did not think that he thought that the pops were being addressed and that it was a small number of people. That he had faith in Ed Wall, the corrections secretary. Legislators, I don't know that we've heard a lot from. We do know that last month some of them were contacted by the parents of someone whose kids work at the facility about how serious things had gotten, and saying that he hadn't heard back from leaders at DOC, at the Department of Corrections, when he raised concerns. So it's been on the radar screen, at least, of some legislators from that area and on the corrections committees for the legislature. But we haven't heard a lot from them about what they want to do or what they think has gone wrong here.
Patrick, as we wrap up, this is a John Doe investigation in the new era of John Doe investigations after the law was changed. Did that affect how those changes affect how this John Doe investigation was undertaken, as far as we know from what we've seen?
It's a little unclear. One thing that's interesting is they launched this John Doe investigation on October 22nd. That's one day before the governor signed it into law. It's unclear if that's a coincidence or if that was done so that they could at least follow some of the old rules by doing that. One thing they say they're investigating is misconduct in office. Under the new John Doe statute, you cannot investigate that crime using the John Doe law. So I don't know where that goes if they have to. I don't know how they're going to handle that part of it.
Patrick, thanks as always for bringing us up to date.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
That was Patrick Marley. He's a state capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can check out his reporting on this issue. It's linked at the Central Time Facebook page.